Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this story definitely caught our attention reading in this morning. It is among the most read on the Bloomberg. It's about the world's mega rich betting on U.S. renters to grow their billions.
Yeah, more specifically, how over the past decade, ultra wealthy individuals and their firms have more than doubled their investments in apartments, largely in the sector known in the U.S. as multifamily housing. This, according, Carol, to the research firm Knight Frank.
All right, let's break it all down and get to these findings with U.S. Bloomberg News, U.S. commercial real estate reporter Natalie Wong joining us on Zoom in New York City. Natalie, Providence, who knew? We'll get to that in just a moment. First of all, tell us what's going on exactly.
Right. Thanks for having me on. So it's this really interesting trend of a period when everyone's shying away from commercial real estate, whether it's the massive institutions like Blackstone or the big banks who are trying to reduce their exposure. And in the meantime, you have these ultra wealthy billionaires that are snatching up properties. I think for them, it's really a diversification play, and they are trying to increase the allocation of their holdings to properties. And in the past, whereas it used to be for offices, clearly with the glut and drop in values of offices today, apartments seem like a much better bet for them.
Is this also a bet on just the fact that so many Americans, with housing prices at a record in many parts of the country, mortgage rates high, that many people aren't going to be able to buy a home?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. We clearly see that there's been a shortage in affordable housing for people that's pushed a lot of people into the rental market. There's a lack of housing even across the rental space across major cities, and that's why we've seen rents continue to rise even over the past year. You know, I think that for these folks, they're kind of looking at this from an extremely long-term play. They're less exposed to the fluctuations in the debt market, and they can often pay with cash, or they have special strong financing relationships with banks that are willing to fund them. And for them, they're looking at this as kind of a stable long-term play and a bet really on the growth of major cities like New York or Chicago, that, you know, even if the property market continues to struggle across commercial real estate for the foreseeable future, some of the best properties will probably still continue to produce income for these folks.
I kidded at the top, Providence, who knew? But we're talking about rent growth over the past 6 months, and Providence, Rhode Island, right, up about 8%. So that's kind of atop the list, even more so than New York City.
Right, that's topping the list. We're seeing Grand Rapids also top the list. I think Hartford is in that list as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it really goes to the boom across maybe cities that, you know, aren't like New York or Chicago. But with the pandemic, we've seen that people might not have to work in the office. They might not necessarily need to do their shopping in retail, but they do need homes. And so we've seen kind of a boom across some of these secondary cities, some of the more suburban areas. And I think that we're seeing these billionaires, ultra wealthy folk try to get in at a time when there's less competition in the space. And also the returns look far more attractive than compared to, say, 2 years ago when we saw double digit rent growth across many of these cities and everyone trying to bid for properties. There's been a step back in today's market, and that kind of provides a perfect buying opportunity for long-term investors that have access to capital today.
Well, speaking of access to capital, Natalie, do we know how these billionaires are financing these these purchases? Are they just paying cash? Are they actually financing them? I mean, rates are very, very high right now.
They're extremely high. In a lot of cases, they're putting in a lot of cash. I think in some situations, banks, it's not like they don't have liquidity. They're just being a lot more cautious as to what they're lending on and who they're lending to, because, you know, we've seen even some of the biggest folks default on their loans. But I think for these billionaires, I mean, relationships between a lender and their borrower is one of the most important things for these types of institutions. And I think if you're a billionaire like Zara founder Amancio Ortega, you might have less hurdles to cross if you're looking for a lender for a deal like this.
I wonder, and I don't know if you've kind of looked into this side of it too, I think about what it means though for the renters and stuff with investors getting involved. Does that mean, is it problematic? I mean, rent is often set by, you know, the market, right? Or the geography, if you will. But I do wonder if this is going to mean higher rental costs potentially for renters.
Yeah, I think some of the specific deals that we quoted in the story, you know, Ortega buying that $232 million luxury apartment building in Chicago, and then another billionaire buying a Manhattan Gramercy apartment, those are kind of already luxury apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. Where I think the clientele for those buildings are used to paying top-notch rents. I don't necessarily see a flood of interest in rent stabilized or rent controlled properties. Investors are definitely shying away from that right now. We're seeing a lot of talk about that, even with the Signature Bank portfolio, where there is a significant chunk of rent stabilized properties, and sort of the question as to who wants to take on that risk.
That's interesting. But I think to these see.
Folks are, yeah, I think these folks are largely targeting some of the higher end apartments, which, you know, there's always going to be demand for at this time.
Do we know, you know, not necessarily average rents, but when you say higher end, give us some context for our listeners and viewers around the world, like, you know, $3,000 a month for a one bedroom?
Yeah, well, I think in Manhattan, I haven't looked at the most recent numbers, but I think we're topping near like 4,000 on average for an apartment, right?
Natalie, this is a fascinating story. And I also thought it was interesting how that before the pandemic, you had the world's rich really focused on office properties, but we know what's going on there. So they've shifted into rental properties and residential. So a really interesting story in terms of what's going on today. Bloomberg News, U.S. commercial real estate reporter. Natalie, thank you so much. Natalie Wong joining us on Zoom in New York City. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right. Yeah, you know, we are waiting really for this war in Ukraine to be over. I think about Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in town last week, speaking before the UN General Assembly, making his case for pressing on with the war effort. You had President Biden coming out, calling on world leaders to stand by Ukraine in its struggle to eject Russian troops, even as Kyiv's allies say that they now expect the war to last for years to come. I, you know, was watching coverage and people are saying, okay, we're getting ready for year number three.
Yeah, it's unbelievable to think that we're there, especially given what we thought when Russia first invaded Ukraine almost 2 years ago, Carol. With more on the war and other global risks, it's really great to have back with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, Ed Price, principal for geopolitical forecasting at Ergo, a global intelligence consulting and forecasting firm. Ed, also a former British trade official representing His Majesty's government to Wall Street and the U.S. official sector from 2017 to 2021. He's advised a number of European and British parliaments, Carol, and worked also in the City of London.
He just knows a lot and has seen a lot.
He's also traveled a lot.
And he's just back from Ukraine. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much, Carol. How are you?
Doing okay. Trying to keep up with it all and try to make sense of it all. You are just back from Ukraine. How did you make sense of what you saw?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the word evil crept into my mind a lot. So there was a sort of theological reaction at the end of the day. I suppose I otherwise tried to make sense of it by putting it into the economics bucket and the military bucket. The economics bucket is, of course, that the Ukrainians are really trying to make their economy work. They're trying to just go to the shops, drink coffees, and go out as much as they can, which is to be welcomed. And of course, on the other hand, the somewhat disappointing counteroffensive. I went just before the offensive itself. And I think that's probably one thing that we're probably going to have to talk about today.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, one thing I wanted to say, and I was talking to our team about this, there was 60 Minutes did a piece, and it was talking about the American aid, the U.S. aid. And one component I wasn't aware of was how much was going into the country to support small businesses. And the whole idea of you've got to have some economy to come back to after this is resolved.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, you have a taxpayer base then. People are, you know, kicking money into the economy. Otherwise, you can have everybody leave. So I thought that was an interesting part of the aid that I wasn't aware of. I was aware of all the military, but it's an important part.
It's hugely important. And let's not also forget that the Ukrainians are still trying to transition out of a Soviet economic model. They have a structural deficit, essentially, that's a social welfare model. They can't really get rid of it. By their own admission, that the older generation is somewhat corrupt. You know, they look at governments askew. Because
another thing,
of course,
I didn't know.
Yes, I mean, I didn't really understand that until I spent some time there. But it's a war on two fronts, right? It's the military war, as I say, and they're also trying to keep the democratic and market institutions not only alive but developing as best they can. And so, of course, the aid that we're sending has to do both.
You know, there are a great number of people in this country who don't want to send aid to the Ukrainian government. What would you say, after being there with your, and seeing with your own eyes what's going on the ground in Ukraine, to those folks here in the U.S. who are telling their representatives, and some representatives are indeed very vocal about it, especially on the Republican side, that they do not want to send aid to Ukraine? What's your message to them?
My message, very respectfully, would be, where do you want to fight Putin? In Ukraine, Poland, Berlin, Paris?
Wow.
It's that simple, I think. And the small amount of money relative to our overall military budget that we have spent in Ukraine, it's about, say, 5%. That has degraded the Russian military capacity in a way that I didn't think I would see in my lifetime, honestly. They were previously, say, 5 days away from a serious attack on NATO. They must be 5 years away now, given the damage we've done to them. So, what do you want for 5% of your military budget? More trucks? More uniforms? I would suggest that killing bad guys for pennies on the dollar is probably a good ROI.
If we don't do it, if countries pull back their support, if the U.S. pulls back its support, then what, potentially?
I think that Putin and the Russians are trying to overhaul the Second World War's settlement. I think they're trying to undo a global order. I don't think that they want to live in a world of rules. And if Ukraine goes down, and, you know, all bets are off. I say that in part because if a new U.S. administration leaves NATO, then we've got a bit of a problem on our hands, because I don't think that the Germans are ready themselves to back Europe's independent deterrent yet. So what happens is carnage.
It's like terrifying.
It is terrifying. I'm wondering, should the U.S. be pushing for a ceasefire? Should our allies be pushing for a ceasefire here? Should that be what they're pushing for in terms of an end to this war?
I think what we should be pushing for is removing Russians from every last inch of Ukrainian territory. That's a maximalist position. There are people in my world who disagree with that and say it's too dangerous. But if we award aggression with any sort of negotiation or peace agreement, we're bucking the number one lesson from world history.
But he's got nukes.
Well, he's got nukes, and so have we. And I think we talked about this before. Like, if we get to that stage, who has a greater faith in the Almighty? I think it's probably us. But before that stage, and if he is indeed bluffing, which I would suggest he is so far, we've crossed every single red line. This is a case of facing down military aggression the same way we should have done in the 1930s with Hitler.
So you have a lot to talk about at an event you have coming up on Thursday, and I want to get into that a little bit. The London Stock Exchange Group and the NYU Center for Global Affairs hosting a discussion of geopolitical risk with you, which you kindly invited us to, and if my show ended earlier, I could make it.
Right, don't worry, next time.
It's Ukraine with Love. Tell us about what you want to emphasize there.
Yeah, that's really kind. It's essentially the same message, right? I don't want to come in here and repeat myself, but I'm really trying to push as an analyst for the case that the aid that we're sending Ukraine must be in place, probably should increase. I think it's rather strange that we haven't offered them more in the way of air power while suggesting that they can conduct combined arms operations. And the essentially, they are fighting for our freedom as well. It's that simple. It's that emotive. So I'm trying to get some powerful, interesting people together, remind them of that, tell them a few stories from Ukraine, because the alternative is pretty grim.
Based on your analysis, Ed, what you've seen over the last 2 years, the world's response, how does this end?
How does the war end?
Yeah.
I think probably the central case right now is that Russia gets to keep a big old chunk of Ukraine. It's embedded itself. You've seen the defensive lines. And at that point, all bets are off as to what happens the decade after that, if they're rewarded. I'm afraid that's the central case right now. I don't think we've given them enough to push the...
Can that be prevented right yet?
Well, I mean, look, this is all a function of how low do you want to go, right? Like, do you really want to push the Russians out with conventional power? And we're creeping towards that. I mean, you'll notice that there is a deep contradiction in American thinking, because on the one hand, we say, as I just said, he probably won't use them, don't worry, so keep on. On the other hand, of course, we haven't sent everything we could have, because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, maybe he might. But it's not going to end well unless there's more military intervention.
And this isn't a European thing. This is a global concern. Has to be.
I would say so, Carol. Yeah. I mean,
I'm asking kind of the obvious, but I do feel like there are people like, that's Europe's problems.
Yes, and I think that's wildly dangerous because, you know, Putin and Xi Jinping do not have the relationship that they claim. Putin is the junior partner. But just imagine if Putin made a feint at the Baltics or, at NATO in conjunction with increased Chinese harassment of Taiwan. Like, these guys are smart. They can figure out a way to spread our resources more thinly. So for my money, I say the more work that we do in Ukraine to hold down this autocratic, aggressive power, the better.
Does that relationship between China and Russia worry you?
It worries me deeply, yes. I'm up at night thinking about that one.
We're running out of time, but like I think about that a lot in terms of that relationship. Do you feel like what we got off of the UN last week, do you feel like there was the right support and just got about 15 seconds?
Absolutely not. No, there needs to be more.
Yeah, it felt like people were getting tired of the situation, which was unfortunate. Good luck with your event Thursday at what time?
6 p.m. LSEG. LSEG, London Stock Exchange Group. If you'd like to come, let me know.
Ed Price, thank you as always. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A lot going on in the auto world continues to be. President Biden on the picket line telling striking auto workers to stick with it. And then you had Ford being blasted by its largest labor union for halting construction on that $3.5 billion battery plant in Michigan amid scrutiny of its ties to a Chinese battery maker by Republican lawmakers. A lot going on.
Yeah, in today's edition of Bloomberg Plugged In, we're looking at the world of EVs. With us, we got a Bloomberg Intelligence senior autos analyst Kevin Tynan from Bloomberg Intelligence headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. Also very pleased to have back with us Diana Lee, co-founder and CEO at Constellation. She's with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Constellation, a marketing platform for the automotive industry. It helps car dealerships reach out to customers. Kevin, I want to start with you and just lay it all out there for us in terms of like historical context here and what it means to have a sitting president actually join a picket line today.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, it's been a little bit since Friday, since the expansion of the walkouts. It's been a little bit quiet. So I think there's real work going on. There's photo op, you know, today with the president being on the picket line. But, you know, I think real work's getting done, you know, and I've said this all along. I think really for the manufacturers, it's about flexibility to rationalize capacity and headcount going forward. And for the union, it's about sharing in the profitability that the automakers have had over the past 10 years.
40% increase in pay, Kevin? President says yes. I'm not sure that many Americans can relate to it, that 40% increase in pay. So walk us through the changing balance sheets potentially for the big three U.S. automakers as we transition to that EV world. I mean, does it that balance sheet change the cost, the gains?
Yeah, look, and I think if it's the labor component of cost of goods, it's a little bit easier to absorb, right? So if you look at even just transaction prices over the life of the last contract, you know, up significantly. So even if there's, you know, 8% a year over the next 4 years, which comes out to be that 36%, you know, prices have actually risen faster than that during the last contract. Now, a lot of the automakers, Ford specifically, are all truck in the U.S., so there's very little additional mix upside for companies like that. Electrification isn't quite there yet, so it's probably going to be something like software and in-vehicle content that helps offset some of those costs. But where it would really hurt and impact the balance sheet would be in, you know, a change in sort of the pension, the healthcare, you know, some of those long-term legacy costs, or being tied into a specific headcount and capacity level that just isn't sustainable as, you know, volume declines and continues to decline going forward.
Diana, we talked with you on Friday, so thank you for coming back. You work closely with the dealerships. Remind our audience what you are hearing from them and how you are thinking about this in regards to them.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of confusion that's going on, and I think the worries that if you are a GM, Ford, or Stellantis dealership right now, you're not sure where your parts are coming from, and you don't know where your vehicles are going to be coming from in the future. Electric vehicles is a really hot topic right now, especially because Tesla has stolen the electric market from the original traditional automakers.
Stolen or just smart and read the market and first mover advantage?
I mean, I think
no offense, many would argue that Tesla woke up the world and said, we can do this. Because I think the traditional automakers were putting out a much longer timeline. And Tesla came in and kind of woke everybody up.
Well, I think what happened differently was the fact that they actually went to court and they decided that they were going to actually go direct to consumer.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. All of America, 25 traditional automakers, all were set long time ago, and the law basically said that you could not sell direct to consumer sales.
But why not? You know, Kevin, come on in on this. Why can't cars be sold direct to consumers? I mean, they are now. Or couldn't be.
Yeah.
Like, who was that protecting?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, an automaker is going to book revenue on the sale to the dealership, right? So when you have companies like Lucid and Rivian and starting to happen to Tesla, where you can't deliver to the consumer all your vehicles, you can't book that revenue. And that's where these price cuts are coming from, right? You're paying to build the vehicle. So all that cost is in your cost of goods, but you're not booking revenue until you sell it or deliver it to the consumer and they pay for it. Where everybody else with a franchise model is booking revenue. So your gross margin is consistent because your revenue is booked and offsetting your cost of goods on the sale to the dealership. The other thing is, look, if there's a 10% haircut in what the manufacturer takes in selling the vehicle to the dealership wholesale, there's no way ever that any automaker at scale is going to recreate the franchise model and deliver and support and service vehicles at a margin better than 10% mm-hmm. ever. So the direct sales model isn't scalable. I mean, people talk about how great it is for Tesla, but it's not, right? And it's not scalable, and it's not sustainable, and it's not something that the legacy automakers can move to.
But one challenge there, Diana, and feel free to just jump in here.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a car dealership, you're making so much of your money based on servicing internal combustion engine vehicles.
Absolutely.
Somebody brings in a car to get an oil change, you know, you're making money on that. Yeah. You know, it doesn't need an oil change? An EV.
Right. But at the end of the day, not all automakers are going to make it, right? You've got all of the traditional automakers, including the big three, now actually coming out with electric vehicles. You have Tesla, you have Lucid. You have Rivian, you have Polestar, you have BYD, Chinese automakers coming in. Sony Honda is building a vehicle and releasing their car in 2026. Overall, not everybody's going to make it, and they're going after hard dollars for EV. Now, what has happened with Detroit Big Three? They won't lose ground right now on EV, selling EV, leasing EV, at the end of the day, if they don't resolve the UAW strike, right? And that's my fear, because when somebody leases a vehicle for 3 years, you're locked for 3 years. You cannot make another brand decision after that. So I think in the next 5 years, the EVs that are going to make it are all going to be, we're going to know who they are, and they are going to be BMW. I believe that. I believe there's going to be the Germans, the Koreans. I think that Japanese brands like Toyota is going to actually also,
what about the
it?
Big three U.S.?
That's what I'm fearing. Like,
What are you afraid of?
If the UAW strike doesn't get resolved eventually, we will not be able to produce these electric vehicles.
So, there's resolution, and then there's like, what's the resolution that needs to happen?
That
not just be done.
We just have to negotiate where it's fair for everybody. But overall, I want the Detroit Three to make it.
Yeah.
These are the only automakers in the U.S.
Well,
we can't not have the U.S. market.
Apart from Tesla.
Yes.
So, Kevin, come back here. I mean, what is the right balance? Does it make sense that workers get more money? I mean, that's the backbone of these automakers. But at the same time, you don't want to increase those legacy costs so that, I don't know, 5 years from now, you know, you're looking at an industry that, you know, like we saw before the great financial crisis, right, that had some real serious problems.
Yeah, well, look, you know, people talk about Tesla dominating EV sales, which are still a very small percentage of mm-hmm. sales in this country. They did it because they lose money on the vehicles for 10 years. And it's not an issue of if or when legacy automakers can make a decent EV, it's when are they profitable. And that's why you get slow moving or a slow play by the domestic manufacturers. They're printing money on full-size internal combustion pickups and SUVs, and then the market or the media or the government wants to move to an unprofitable alternative, and it's just not ready. And that makes it very messy, and that's where it is right now. So it's not a matter of, you know, can GM figure out how to make an EV? They made an EV in the 1990s and right. saw what that cost looked like, that it was yeah. unsustainable. So what's going to happen with the additional costs
yeah.
in this labor contract is that the small cars, the unprofitable
right.
cars, the inexpensive cars are going to get lopped off the bottom of the portfolio
right.
and prices are going to go higher for everybody.
All right. So glad we got to speak with both of you. Kevin Tynan, he is our senior autos analyst for our Bloomberg Intelligence team. And Diana Lee, thanks so much for coming back, co-founder and CEO at Constellation.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization,
we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody. Just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. We've got stocks near their lows of the session. And this, you know, as we really have seen a bit of a market reset when it comes to yield expectations. We were just breaking down the markets with John Tucker. 10-year note, 4.54, and you've got that 2-year note with a yield of 5.12.
I'm really interested to hear what our next guest has to think. Very pleased to have with us Nancy Tengler, Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tengler Investments. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Also, her new book, The Women's Guide to Successful Investing, is out now. Nancy, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm good, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to start with just the markets today. I mean, you picked quite a day to come join us.
Yeah.
You know, you heard it just
another
now.
Another quite a day, right?
Yeah, John Tucker, who said that, you know, you take a time machine all the way back to June to see, what you know, the S&P 500. Looking like this. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. But effectively, you know, there have been a lot of triggers. Let me put it that way. So we had the Fed. Now we've got the potential shutdown. Then we've had, you know, we've got earnings upcoming. And we had, you know, we've got uncertainty around how high rates are going to stay for how long. But I actually don't think much of that matters in the long term. There's also window dressing going on and a quarter, and then you're going to get the mutual funds shoring up their portfolios in October. I think what really matters, what's going to matter and will continue to matter, is earnings. And I'm actually a little more optimistic than the street. I've been doing this for 40 years, I'm sorry to report. And, you know, interest rates have been at this level much of my career. And yeah. So real rates, if you go back to the 90s, sort of vacillated between 2% and 4.5%. And they're at 2% now on the 10-year. So I don't find any of this super distressing. I'm not nearly as worried about interest rates as it relates to technology as I am about a stronger dollar. I think that's going to be a challenge to earnings in the coming quarter. But mostly, I view this as an opportunity to step in and pick off some names. Just like last October, we were adding to technology names pretty robustly. We were trimming those names in May, June, July, and adding to industrials. I'll be doing the flip, if possible, in the coming weeks. So buy into technology? Mm-hmm. Continue to, yep. Interesting. Which technology? So we really like the established tech names. I don't want to say old economy. Some of them are old economy, Carol, but in general, the names that are actually monetizing AI and cloud computing. So take a name like in the old economy space, Oracle. They reported, the street thought it was disappointing. I didn't think it was that disappointing. They doubled their cloud computing, AI cloud computing business, that they generate, you know, 70 or 80% of their revenue. 70% is renewable. Mm-hmm. So this is a company, the margins are improving, even with Cerner, which was the negative, margins are improving. So we've been adding to that name. But I'd love another chance at Microsoft at $211 a share. Yeah. Like where it was last fall.
Okay, what else? Microsoft, Oracle, what else are you adding?
Broadcom.
So,
can I ask you, NVIDIA, not of interest?
It is of interest.
Or is it just so expensive right now? It was cheap enough on our valuation work for about 20 minutes and we missed it. So we're watching it. We have it loaded. We've done all the fundamental work, which is not terribly exciting. I mean, you know, it's a great company. Did we have a headline on OpenAI in terms of valuation?
Yeah, $90 billion, Carol.
Yeah.
This is based on a share sale.
This is coming from
OpenAI.
The Wall Street Journal.
Sounds like a pretty hefty valuation.
Yeah,
for a
it does.
Private company.
It does.
Where do you stand on the AI revolution?
I actually think that it's going to improve productivity. I think there's going to be new startups we don't know anything about. But what you're seeing is all the major players, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, they're all investing in sort of the leading edge innovators. And Microsoft for sure has figured out a way to monetize. We like the names that are already making money off it. So a name like Broadcom, they think about 25% of their revenues are going to come from AI, cloud, enterprise chips. That's our largest holding actually across all of our strategies.
Okay, so you say you see this as a buying opportunity. Do you think there's further to go when it comes to declines on the S&P?
Yeah.
How much further?
I mean, if I don't really do market
forecasts.
You've
been doing this for 40 years. Come on, Nancy.
I wouldn't be surprised if we had another 5 to 7% down.
Okay.
It could be more, but we end the year higher from these levels and from whatever level we bottom out at. Okay. And that I can say with, I think, somewhat certainty.
Help me out, though, with the Treasury trade. We had another two-year auction, yield stopping at 5.085%, highest auction yield in more than 17 years. I feel like we keep having these superlatives when it comes to the Treasury trade. But as you say, it was the negative rate cycle that was the anomaly.
Yes.
So why is it that it feels so bad?
I think, look, at the average person in this business has not been doing it for 40 years. They've been doing it for 15, 20, where we were in a perennial bull market for bonds. And so I think there's this consternation of, I've never seen this before. I mean, my first mortgage was 12.5%. And we
might be getting close to the
we paid it. Days. We were able to make the payments. You know, you make adjustments. But I think, but interest rates were also at 18%.
Yeah.
So I think the Fed and the federal government has really distorted the short end, the Treasury, and so, I mean, I'm taking advantage of it. We were out of bonds in August of 2020 when the 10-year yield hit 50 basis points. We moved our clients back into short ladders a year ago, and we continue to renew those
short ladders. Short ladders meaning money markets or what?
We buy treasuries or corporates depending on their personal preference, and we build short ladders that some have maturities of 3 years, but many just have a maturity under a year. And we just keep rolling them.
So I'm just thinking about the book that you've got out, The Women's Guide to Successful Investing. So what would you know, women, men, we're really different, John Tucker.
Well, easy where you're going with this.
Well, I want to know, Nancy, and I know we've talked to you a little bit about your book, which is out. Like, what is the differences that we need to be thinking about, and why a book specifically for women?
Yeah, so I retired from the business for about 5 years, and I went and got a master's in creative writing. Don't ask. But I spent a lot of time meeting women at my kids' sporting events.
If you wrote some romance novels, it's really okay, Nancy. We still like you.
I'd love to. And I met these really smart women, and they'd say to me, well, what did you do? And I said, well, I was, you know, chief investment officer. And they'd recoil physically. They were not involved with the decision making in their households. They didn't know the passwords. They didn't care. And then I started to do the research, and I was like, this is the book. I'd written a memoir, so haha, funny. Yeah. Wasn't a romance novel. I decided to write this book because average age of first divorce in the U.S. is 30. Average age of a widow is 59. That's exactly how old I was when my husband passed away.
Wow.
There is no safety net
for
women. There isn't any health care if they're not working. And if they don't know what's going on in the portfolios, it's a bad time to learn. And so I really wanted to encourage women. Turns out research shows, live research of real portfolios, that women perform better than their male counterparts. In every study that's been done, they perform particularly well against single men because they don't have that sort of drive for beat the index. And
love
we
this.
Control $95 trillion of wealth globally and
hear,
are adding
hear
5
that,
trillion.
You hear that, dude?
I hear it. Men
all right.
suck, don't
we have
they?
To run. I know we'll talk more about this in the future. Nancy, thank you so much. Nancy Tangler, Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tangler Investments.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.